As Marge said, we've been talking a lot about gender-based violence, but we're hoping to share with you some actions that have taken place in efforts to intervene rather than just identify. So how can we change this pattern? And one project that I was involved with was in Ethiopia, where we trained lay psychosocial counselors. So first of all, a presenter disclosure, no financial benefits. So again, the context. I think all of us are aware of the very important WHO study that was done in, published in 2005, but the years up leading to 2005, the studies took place. And in particular, Ethiopia showed some very, very interesting information. The study was conducted in 2002, so 10 years ago, but I can guarantee nothing's changed. The research, they had Ethiopian research partners from ministries down to community organizations. They interviewed over 3,000 women. 76% of those women were illiterate. So that'll tell you about the access to education for women in Ethiopia. And 64% had no work outside of the home. And just let me add, Ethiopia is a very rural country. Addis Ababa is sort of the urban central point up in the northern part, but the rest of the country is very, very rural. So what they found in this study, which was already referenced, is that 70% of the women interviewed had experienced either physical or sexual violence or both in their lifetime. 49% of those women who ever had a partner experienced physical violence. 29% was within the last 12 months. 19% had been injured, and you can see by looking at the slide that the various kinds of injuries, you know, sprains, dislocations, fractures, tears, injuries to eyes, broken teeth, you know, all those battering injuries that can take place. And a third of them needed to see a healthcare provider as a result of those injuries. So it's pretty severe. Sexual violence, 59% of the women who were interviewed had a partner where they experienced sexual violence taking place, and 44% had been within the last 12 months. 17% reported their first sexual experience was forced. And 7% reported the occurrence of sexual abuse before they were the age of 15. So you can tell Ethiopia is not a great place to be a woman. So partners, that's the context of the situation and how important it is to address the issue of gender-based violence in Ethiopia. At the time, I worked for Heartland Alliance International, which is one of the other programs. And its headquarters are in Chicago. It's a service-based health, it conceptualizes itself as a service-based human rights organization and focuses on comprehensive health, so the whole person, not just physical health, not just one aspect of health, but the whole person, and also how social determinants impact health, so taking actions through social and economic justice. So that's one partner, US-based. They identified Bright Image for Generation Association, or BIGA is how they refer to themselves, which was a indigenous and Ethiopian not-for-profit civil society organization that was established by a group of mostly women. There was one guy, there was like three women who were Ethiopian attorneys and one man who volunteered their time, effort, and money out of their pocket to start this organization initially. And they were managed to get certified by the Ministry of Justice in 2005. So they were an official CSO in Ethiopia. So BIGA is located in the Southern Nations, Nationalities, and Peoples region of Ethiopia. And the main office is in Awassa, where the green area is Awassa. And they had an affiliate office in Dila, which isn't on the map. It's very small, but it was just to the south of Awassa. So you can see that it's in the southern rural region. So in 2009, Heartland Alliance and BIGA applied together and received a two-year USAID grant, which they called We Care. Women of Ethiopia, Community Advancement for Recovery and Empowerment. And one of the things that BIGA was already doing with funding from a previous grant was something called self-help groups. And the self-help groups found women who already, the living situation in Ethiopia, if you go into a neighborhood, there's like compounds. There'll be like a gate and you walk in and there's all these little doors that are separate houses, but they're like one room. So, and that's sort of a housing compound. So what they did is they went out and did outreach in these housing neighborhood compounds and identified women who were willing to come together as a group. And then they developed a curriculum where they taught them about financial, sort of financial responsibility, right? Of how do you, they all had to contribute, they opened an account, everyone took a turn, they took loans out from this account, and you paid it back with interest. So someone might take out money, buy a barrel of oil, then sell bottles at the market and make a profit, pay back their loan, have a little money to maintain their family life. So that was the kind of self-help group. So it was a very community supportive. So with the funding from USAID, they expanded, they like tripled the number of self-help groups. So they expanded the outreach to develop these neighborhood organizations. And here's a photograph and an example. The man there, Solomon, is one of the instructors in the self-help groups. And so this is what women do. They sit around in this group. They make coffee. They have their ledger. And everyone is doing reporting on their successes and challenges and their problem solving. So there's a lot of support going on. And if you can see in the back, I just want to add this anecdotal story. There's two men. Right? So one of the things that I asked as I was learning, on the ground learning and visiting these self-help groups, and the question I posed to the women is, what are your husbands? Those of you that have husbands, what do they think about you bringing money in? And one of the women said, you see that man over there? He's my husband. Why don't you ask him? So we called him over, and he was like, this is great. And actually what the women then went on to talk about is abuse, arguments, disagreements in the household were down because they were able to bring some financial help into the family life. So that's an important point. So that's the self-help groups. They were able to increase. What we then added to that grant was a new service of psychosocial counselors that were trained to assess and provide supportive services to women and children impacted by gender-based violence. So that was the goal. And the photograph there is three of the counselors that got trained. So the startup training, what we did with once BIGA hired their counselors, we talked about how do you do a first interview. How would you use an assessment tool? Because we wanted to look at the prevalence of PTSD and depression among women. How do you make a plan for what you're going to do? How do you keep notes? All those kinds of things. And then introduction to basic counseling skills, listening techniques was very, very, very important. People don't always know how to listen, right? So we had to really work on that. There was a lot of practicing that we did. The training was 40 plus hours a week and went on for 2 weeks. So it was intensive. We also talked about group counseling, but not group in terms of therapy, but more group into like psychoeducational. How can we inform women about mental health needs? Or activity groups to promote social cohesion, or problem focus groups where women share a problem and can help each other. And then of course, another component of any time you're training a counselor is the impact on them. What kind of exposure they're going to have when they listen to the stories of women, and how can they take care of themselves. So the assessment tools that we agreed on after reviewing a number of them was the patient health questionnaire for depression and then the PTSD checklist for civilians. And then we spent a lot of time adapting and modifying those culturally and linguistically. So that involves sitting down, talking about it. Like an example is on the patient health questionnaire, it says, are you able to concentrate and do activities like watch TV? Well, there's no TV, right? But people listen to the radio. So can they listen to the radio? It's those little kinds of things that we sat around and talked about, and would this fit for here or not? And then we had to do translation, which is always interesting. So we went from English to Amharic, and then I sent it, the person isn't here, but I sent it to someone in the U.S., and she back translated it from Amharic to English, and then we sat down and looked at sort of the discrepancies and how can we fine tune it. And so then we had our instruments ready. So I met with all the counselors, talked to them about what their motivations were for having applied and wanting to do this work, what were their levels, like sort of natural, sort of inherent capacity to be counselors versus how much were they going to have to really learn. We spent a lot of time talking about the Ethiopian context, presenting the results of the WHO study, but also their awareness of being community members, of what is going on in their communities relating to interpersonal violence, abuse of children. And then we began to look at what are the consequences of that. What do we know from studies, and what do they know in terms of the Ethiopian context? What is the psychological harm that is the result of this kind of violence? And then also, what is the cultural expression of that? Not to assume that the symptom presentation would be the same. So a lot of discussion, a lot of interaction, a lot of practicing goes on. Then the plan was is that I would come back and do follow-up training, addressing very specifically the feedback I'm getting from counselors, such as marital conflict, domestic violence, forced marriage, which is still commonly practiced in Ethiopia, bride abduction, rapes, adolescent issues, many things we anticipated would emerge that we were going to have to address. And then also skill building would ultimately take place with follow-up visits. So this was the training schedule that we planned, but when I went back in September, total staff turnover. Everyone that had been hired and worked there for about a year or so had left. So I had all new counselors that we started over with. So, you know, you do what you have to do, okay? So we started over with a new set of counselors and did all the training. So the counselors, the first group of counselors started seeing patients or clients, women participants, in January of 2010, and just ended this past June. The focus was on women who experienced gender-based violence. What we learned was that most of the counseling was supportive, listening, helping them think about alternative behaviors, just a very supportive, non-directive type of counseling. Most of the women stayed in a counseling relationship for at least 6 months. And that we assess the prevalence of depression and PTSD at the intake. So we had a baseline, 3 months, and 6 months. Just so you know who the referrals came from, very few came from the self-help groups, which I was surprised, but then when I thought about it, it wasn't surprising because actually the economic input was helpful. The majority came from police and other local authorities, and then also health clinics out in the community, and then program participants who had gotten help. So here, the next few slides are the results. So you can see the ages of the participants ranged from adolescents to, you know, more than 35, but the primary age group is 18 to 34. So young women, right? We had 301. Okay, so the patient health questionnaire, which was our depression assessment, you can see that at intake, there, you know, like almost 68% of the women had reported severe depression. And if you add in the moderately severe, it's almost the entire, right? It's about 96%, 95% of the women. At 3 months, drastic improvement, right? And at 6 months, even more drastic improvement. So that at the end of 6 months, and 83% of the women continued through 6 months, reported significant alleviation of their depressive symptoms. Okay, and I'll talk about that. The same with the PTSD assessment. You can see that scores greater than 50 are significant for PTSD, and that the 50 to 70, most of the women at intake were in that category. And as 3 months and 6 months, significant improvement again. Okay, so this looks at the occurrence of PTSD and depression. So at baseline, you can see that about 90% of the women had both PTSD and depression. A small percentage had depression only, and barely significant, that nothing. And then no one had PTSD only, so that bar isn't even there. So at you can see it's like at 3 months, 80% were saying, I'm much better. And at 6 months, they all were reporting better, okay, improvement. So discussion, okay? Just to close up and talk a little bit about, these were drastic. And actually this morning I talked to someone at a presentation, and it was about sort of the importance of social resources, social support. So I think one of the positives about this is that there was good engagement, right? And active participation. The women came because of economic reasons. They were coming twice a month, but they came for a long time. They came for at least 6 months. That was when we stopped the follow-up. The women were reporting feeling better, and what one of the things that I think is really important, what came out of that was the identification of a need to develop a safe house. And BIGA, to their credit, heard that, and now in Owosso there is a safe house for women to come to. And that was done in collaboration with the police, because they were getting all these women who were in dire straits. You know, the concern would be, why did women get so much better? You know, and there's, you know, lots of reasons to think about. When people hear about a new program that's going to give them services, did they over-report the intensity of their symptoms so that they could get in for the program? Because, you know, this is a new program. This is a new idea, counseling. And then at the end, were they over-reporting improvement because they didn't want to be a disappointment to anyone? You know, we got to factor in that as a possibility. The staff turnover was a concern for me, and I worried about what was the impact of secondary trauma on the counselors. And then also, being a counselor, there's no professional status. It was a new position. So did they feel at all dissed by the self-help group people? I mean, those are concerns that I had. But I think the important thing of this is that we were able to train local people. The counselors had been teachers or nurses, so they were already in helping professionals. They were interested, they were concerned, they were trained to listen and provide supportive. And whether or not the improvement was as drastic as what the results show, it shows that women can help women get better, and the importance of social support to break the silence and provide an arena where you can disclose and be heard, right, to be listened to and responded to in a very positive way and feel supported. So I think there is like infinite possibility in this model in other countries as well. So thank you.